Welcome to Listeners' Voices on KTWH. I'm Fran. Oh, no. No, I'm kidding.
Is your name actually Francis?
It is, yes. Name? Okay. Yes, and it's for everyone's information. If you ever get confused, we just had someone confused in the last day here. CES is for hers, women who are named Francis. It's spelled CES, and IS is for his.
Yes.
Yeah, but we're both named Francis.
And that's a very good way to remember it. But I am Francis, and you are Fran. I've also been called Fran for many, many years in different places I've been with different people. So we tend to get that confused here, not as much as you'd think.
And what were you called growing up, like by your family members?
Oh, God, don't ask me to tell you that.
I mean, for your name, not other things like Rugrat, what my brother called me, but yeah.
either Franny or Frankie.
Oh, okay, and I was Francie.
Francie.
Yeah, so maybe we should distinguish ourselves by
no, let's
Frankie
not.
And Francie. No,
I'm going to stick with Francis for this particular gig. Place and time.
Okay. Okay, so now that we've processed that, this is the Listener's Voices show where we invite people to respond to our prompt of the week. And let's see.
So this week's prompt?
Yes. Yeah, it's the second week. We're dealing with my first job. And we had a good turnout last week, and we've got a few more to share with you this week. And I had the funniest text after last week. So Richmond shared with us last week his story about getting a job. I forget where it was, but it was a cleaning job. And there was no, as I recall, nothing to the interview except the woman handed him a mop, a bucket and mop, and asked him to mop the floor, demonstrate mopping the floor. And he explained to us exactly what he did, the figure eight on the floor, backing up and then putting it in the bucket and squeezing it out, and he got the job on the spot.
A mopping interview.
Mopping interview, right, yeah, yeah, an experiential interview. And so Francis happened to find a song called Rag Mop to follow that up with. Thank you for your research in our music library here. And I got a text from my sister, who's about 7 years older than I am, and she said, you probably don't remember this, but when she was, I think she said she was about 10 years old, and she and her best friend, Karen Westland, this was all in Clarissa, Minnesota, in the kind of Lake Wobegon of central Minnesota, they performed that song, Rag Mop, for a talent show or something. And I thought that was really fun. You can imagine, because she was listening to the show in Denver, where she lives, actually. And so I can imagine she was quite surprised to hear that come on. So a lucky choice there. So, yeah, we have about four more recorded submissions this week and a couple of written ones. But let's see, a couple things we wanted to share first. We've been saying that asking you to turn in your submissions by Wednesday nights, and really, Thursday by noon would be just fine. And there are a couple of reasons for that we don't need to explain. But anyway, we welcome your submissions up till noon on Thursdays. And anything that's late, we can always share the next week as well. We're totally open to people responding to previous prompts. This was the second week for jobs. And we're also going to shift gears then and just have 1 week per prompt or per question or issue.
One subject a week.
Right.
Rather than carrying it over to the second week.
Right. Partly just for publicity, for putting word out there, it gets confusing. But
and where do we have it out there?
In the newspapers, every week in the North Shore Journal, and approximately every other week in the Lake County Press. And then there's an email that goes out. You can get on our email list. We encourage people to do that, and we'll try to mention it several times. The address is ktwhwriters@gmail.com. And you can send us an email there, and we'll put you on the list. A weekly email goes out on Friday or Saturday announcing the prompt for the next week.
And I had some friends of mine respond, and they texted me their voice recordings, and I was not able to process the text. I couldn't then send it to myself or get it into a form that we could then download and record.
Yeah.
So if you feel compelled to make a voice recording, which is very easy to do on your phone.
We like that. We like to hear your
voice.
Mm-hmm.
Then please send it to this email address that Fran just gave you.
Right, rather than any phone number, which most you wouldn't have a phone number.
Yeah.
But the office phone doesn't accept things like that. And there isn't usually somebody here who would take down
answer
by
dictation.
Yeah, answer it and be willing to sit there and take dictation of your submission,
no, no, no.
Your written
so
submission.
It is very easy to make a voice memo on your phone, and it's equally easy to send it to ktwhwriters@gmail.com.
Right. The little share icon usually gives you the option of texting or emailing or some other options too. So that's probably how all four of these came to us, I think, today that we have to share. Let's see. Anything else I wanted to announce first? I guess not. Kind of covered it.
What about the next prompt now then, that we're done with this one?
That's a good idea. Right. We're still the rest of the show will be about the My First Jobs responses. But for next week, you can start thinking about this right now. If you're on our email list, you already found out about this yesterday. And it's in the North Shore Journal this week. It is one of the biggies. It's Lake Superior. Any kind of experiences around Lake Superior or just what it means to you? And it can be historic or your own experience or whatever.
I will promise to give you a recollection. It's not mine, mm-hmm. but it's a story from my sister's kids.
Mm.
And it's a bit harrowing, but I will definitely answer for next time.
Good. Well, I have my own harrowing experience. It was harrowing to me. I don't know. I'm going to have to work on sharing on that. But for sure, I've got a story, too. And then the other reflections about its role in our psyches, kind of. So we'll go with that for next week. And, let's just briefly run down what we can remember about prompts of the past, which you are still welcome to respond to at any time. So we started this back, I think, in February or so with a couple of episodes about the weird winter that we were having then and have continued
weather.
To have.
It was just generally weather.
Right,
the winter weather, was it?
Yeah, it was we call it the exceptional winter, and mm-hmm. because people had such different feelings about it, we didn't want to call it the awful winter. To me, it was an awful winter with no snow, but some people
were. I was surprised at how many people were very receptive to it. But
that actually calls to mind a future prompt. This won't happen right away, but someone suggested the prompt of what keeps you here or what brought you here to our region, and I remember you, Frances, saying one of the reasons you came here was to be able to ski. And if it was going to be like this, never
I
mind.
I might have to rethink it. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And the lovely winters we usually have here is certainly one thing that keeps me here. And we will have that for a prompt sometime in the next month, I would say. So then we followed that up with a songs episode, my favorite songs or what songs that people identify with. And then you remember after that?
Number three, was it? Pets was number five, wasn't it?
Probably. Animal Companions was, we had a couple episodes on that. We also had businesses that you either miss
yes.
from the old days in Two Harbors or that you wish we had. I think that kind of brings it up to the current.
Yeah, with the doubling up of
right.
two
yeah,
weeks
most
at
of
the time.
Them we had 2 weeks per prompt.
And, you know, like, you can always answer the old prompts. So if
right.
Lake Superior becomes a gush of feedback, we will certainly make time for it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, in fact, if we did have too much for one show, the problem is we have to decide early in the week before we know what the response is going to be.
For advertisement.
Yeah, for the purposes of the newspaper. The other way we outreach, if you listen to enough to KTWH, you will hear promos during the week, too. There's a promo for each episode's prompt. All right. Well, let's get into one of these responses. And if people want to hear, if this is your first time listening and you're wondering, well, what do people really have to say? this one is Julie's. That was the first one to come in. She just missed the deadline for last weekend, but I assured her we'll be listening to you this week. So here's Julie.
When I was 15, I moved to Missoula, Montana to spend the summer with my mom. My first job outside of our family business was working at a laundromat. And my role there was as an ironer. So there was probably a 12-foot roller system of irons, and we would feed sheets, tablecloths, and napkins through there for an entire day. In this space, it was probably 100 degrees, and the humidity was also very high, so it was a very hot, sweaty job, and I thought I did pretty good as a 15-year-old showing up every day. One day, I decided that I was going to take an afternoon off, so at lunchtime, I called in sick. And I remember my stepdad being very angry with me because I was so irresponsible. And here I thought, wow, I am being such a responsible 15-year-old by working 40 hours a week during my first summer in a new town. I ended that job at the end of the summer of 1991, I suppose, and the laundromat went on to close because it was founded that they had been dumping all of their dry cleaning waste into the Clark Fork River in Montana, and it ended up becoming a Superfund area because they had dumped so much stuff into the river there that they had to clean it up. This is Julie Soderberg, and this is the story of my first job.
Kind of a horror story at the end there.
Seriously.
I hope she didn't suffer any long-term damages just from exposure to that stuff, but working on the irons, and so that brought back, I did that exact same thing for, probably just a couple of weeks or something. So there was an era back before I moved up to this area, and that was about 1971, so it would have been late 60s, 70. I and a friend worked for a temporary agency. You know, Manpower is what it was called. I don't know if it exists still, but they...
It does.
Okay. They plug in wherever they, you know, people come to them with their needs, and they find people to fulfill them. I did a lot of different things. And one of them was at the American Linen Supply Company in Minneapolis, and I know exactly what Julie's talking about, those big, wide rollers and the heat, and they gave us salt tablets, I think, to try to...
Oh, my.
Yeah. yep, I can envision that and feel it even with your description, Julie. Thank you for that. And sometime I'll regale you with tales of other temporary jobs.
I've had many myself. And I actually liked working for temp agencies because when I had reached my limit of being able to handle the whatever menial job it was, I would just tell them, I've got two or three more days here, and put myself back on the list, and I would try something new. So it was a bit of a variety.
Well, when we get to the prompt, another future prompt that people can be thinking about is jobs I have quit and why. And one of those temporary jobs through the temporary agency is a classic. I think it was through the temporary agency. It might not have been, actually, but it was a very short-term job, and it felt like it. But I'm saving that for.
I have a friend of mine from St. Cloud who's been working on a book about all the jobs she's had in her lifetime, and we've thought about adding in other people's stories as well, because everybody's got some sort of story about a job.
Yeah. But when we get to sharing our temporary stories, I'm going to bring in a paper I wrote in the late 1980s, in which I listed all the jobs I had up to that point. And things stabilized quite a bit after that, but it's quite a list.
You have writings that you've done from the 80s still.
Yeah. Well, that was an exceptional paper, but some family members are familiar with. But I won't burden you with that whole story.
We'll
but it's just that one page of the long list of jobs. All right, people want to hear about other people's jobs, and this was an interview that Frances worked out for us here. Maybe you can explain who Josh is.
This is my future nephew-in-law, and I was spending Easter at my niece's house. And I'll tell you after the story,
okay,
my connection to it.
Okay. Nope.
This week's prompt is called My First Job. You have a story about your first job?
Oh, my first job was farming at Uncle Tim's.
Oh, was it? That's
yep.
hard, huh?
Yep. I was probably 10. I worked there. I didn't have summer vacations. That was my summer.
So after you're done with school, you just went straight to Uncle Tim's and
yep.
and worked then, the dairy? What did he have you do?
Oh, feed the cows, scrape the pens, scrape the pig pen, bale hay.
Did you milk them at that
fix fences,
point?
Yeah.
You milk
them? Yep. We didn't have, the kids didn't have to do the morning milking because they did it at 2 and 2. So 2 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon. They didn't make the kids get up at 2 in the morning, which was nice. But we used to get up and play tricks on my grandma and grandpa.
Well, yeah.
They'd carry the milkers out to the barn, and then we'd carry them back in the milk house. They thought they were
they think
losing
they didn't
their
do
minds.
It.
Yes. Yep.
So you say we. Who was working with you at that time?
My cousin Brian. He lived there. It was my Uncle Tim's son.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yep.
And your grandparents lived there too?
Yep. They lived in the trailer house that was across the driveway.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so how many hours would you work?
From about 7:30 in the morning till about 11. Go
it's
screw
not yours.
Around. Screw around. We'd hunt a little bit or something. And then we'd milk cows from about 2 to 4:30. Yep.
Every day of the week, like 7 days a week?
I didn't go there on Sundays.
Okay.
Yeah. But they were
so
there.
What? How did that set you up for a working life? Did you think?
I guess it gave me a good work ethic, watching those people, you know, work hard their whole entire life.
And you're working hard, too.
Every day.
Did you get paid?
Yes. Like, I don't know, $8 a day or something. Very little, yes.
What was your first adult job?
Tombstone Pizza. I worked there the summer after I graduated high school. Not fun.
No?
No.
I always thought it would be fun to work at a pizzeria.
No, it was fast-paced. Just, it wasn't fun.
They weren't nice.
No.
Was it family style?
No, it wasn't. Bunch of crabby people.
Cows in the moo yard are making their plans for the long winter nights and the cold winter hands. Some out in the field are covered with snow. The black ones turn white and the white ones don't show. Big lumps in the sunset between bovine dreams. Their icicled udders are waiting. Up from the road comes the sound of the wheel. Just an old ice cream wagon. You say, I know how you feel. Some dream of India, where their cousins are stars. But they don't like the crowds. They stay where they are. Of Florida, of roaming the beach with metal detectors for gold they can reach. Well, what can you do? It's the ice or the flies, the temperature snowing, the tales going by. It's a dairy existence, and I must conclude. Cold milk. milk in a bottle still beats frozen food.
So that was John Gorka, Winter Cows, goes out to Josh. So tell us more about Josh and the farm.
I didn't realize that the dairy across the street from Josh's property was his uncle's dairy farm. And when I found that out, I'm like, wow, I'd really love to go meet him and see them what they do. And so one time I went to go visit, and I spent, they arranged for me to go meet Uncle Tim. I showed up all on my own and told him I wanted to work with him for a shift. And he was a little,
skeptical?
Skeptical as to why I, this old lady, would want to come and milk cows for an afternoon. But it was really interesting, and I got to know a little bit about them. And he's been working at that dairy since he was 9 years old, and he's in his mid to late 80s now.
Wow.
And he works 7 days a week. Cows don't take a day off.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's been running that whole establishment. And after him, there's nobody in the family that wants to be doing this.
Oh,
so
my.
It will be the end of, there's been a lot of loss of dairy farmers in Wisconsin, as I'm sure you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was fascinating.
How many cows on the, about?
I'm guessing maybe 50.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
He told me exactly. But
It's
a lot of cows. They hook them all up. It's systematic for sure, but they're very interesting.
So I wonder if there's a temp agency that, you know, if he should keel over one day and just suddenly
or
go.
Or even be sick for a day.
Yeah, yeah. 50 cows needing to be milked is not a joke.
Luckily, Josh does live across the street from him, and I'm sure in an emergency the family would rally.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Yep. Well, next up, we've got Lil. This was Richmond over at Bayview Apartment building. Recruited one of his co-housers there. And I'll tell you a little more about this place after she shares her first job. I was going to play this after her contribution, but we'll listen to it now because she was really happy about her job.
Thank you.
Well, I'll have to do a little exploring. Apparently that interview with Lil is not where we think it is, but we will find it still and play it. That was Billie Holiday, of course, singing Nice Work If You Can Get It. And Lil was really pleased with her summer job working at a resort along the North Shore. And so while you read this from Michelle Miller, well, we had a couple of written submissions this week as well. And so we'll hear that. And meanwhile, I'll poke around and see if I can't find that file.
All right. We have from Michelle Miller, Two Harbors. I've been earning money in exchange for work for a service provided for nearly 45 years. The best way to tackle this prompt is to break it down into three sections. My first paying job, my first job in the real workforce, and my first professional job utilizing my degree. My first job at age 11 was babysitting for neighbor's six-month-old son. It taught me to manage my time, be respectful of others' property, put others' needs before mine, be creative in a pinch, and begin to understand the art of being financially independent. I worked for this family for 6 years and had the pleasure of being part of their three children growing up. We actively stayed involved in each other's lives for nearly 30 years, and I am honored this friendship and experience is such an important part of who I am. My first job, where I had a supervisor, paid taxes, it was on a regular schedule, was as a waitress for a small, locally owned diner. It was a wonderful experience to meet and have different types of relationships with those I shared the community with. One big takeaway: do your best and do not take anything personal. I was tipped one penny from a customer. At the age of 17, I had a lot of questions of society and how this system really works. I earned my degree in therapeutic recreation and could work in a variety of environments. The first job that I felt like a good fit was working in a residential treatment center and shelter facility for teenage girls. I pounded on clay, danced, and wrote poetry on the journey to support my clients. This job secured my belief in the power of art, creativity, and self-expression to make a difference. And so goes my journey. The end.
Thank you, Michelle.
Yeah.
Another varied path. Well, I found a different way to try to play Lil's submission here, so we will give this one a try.
Hello, listeners. This is your roving reporter, Richmond, once again coming to you from the Bayview Terrace. Today's interview is with Lil and the Gals about her first job at the Wonderland Tourist Courts, evidently owned by her sister and brother-in-law. Wonderland Tourist Court along the scenic highway. Take it away, Lil.
Cabins for my sister and brother-in-law. Aww. The Wonderland Tourist Court.
The Wonderland.
Was that down on the highway?
Tourist Court.
On the Wonderland.
On the scenic.
On the scenic highway.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
On the scenic highway, and what was it called?
The Wonderland Tourist Court.
Wow, what a wonderful name.
Yeah.
Tourist Court.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't know that was its whole name.
Yeah, 22 cabins.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
22 like cabins.
Mm-hmm.
How did you like it?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah?
I met a lot of people.
Uh-huh.
And it was very interesting.
I'll bet.
All the people, different people you meet.
Yep. And their stories.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those people you liked and some?
Some, no.
Do you remember how much you were paid?
Maybe like $1 an hour back then.
Then
I did work at Shorecrest as a waitress. $1.25 an hour there.
Oh, that's that's a big raise, 25%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How long did you work there?
At Wonderland?
Yeah.
I was there 3 summers.
3 summers?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
Were you in high school then? Or?
Mm-hmm. Worked in the summer and school in the winter and back in the summer. And then the third summer I was done with school.
But you didn't grow up here, so you lived down south.
Mm-hmm.
And then you came up here.
I grew up south of St. Cloud.
Yeah.
In a little town called South Haven.
I thought you grew up in Knife River.
No.
Oh, okay.
My husband did.
I see.
Ken Hansen, yeah.
Okay.
He grew up in Knife River.
So is that where when you came to clean the cabins for your sister's business in Knife River, is that when you met Ken, sort of?
Okay. How I met him? Wonderland Tourist Court also had a restaurant and a bar.
Okay.
So I worked both places, and that's how I met Ken.
Okay, that's how you met your husband, your future husband.
Yes.
Cool.
He was home on furlough.
Well,
from the Navy.
That was a really good first job.
No kidding. A lot of memories.
A lot of memories.
I did not know that place had a restaurant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah.
Did he ask you out?
Yes.
You better have.
He asked me out. Then we were going quite a while together.
Yeah.
He said, how did I get mixed up with a farmer's daughter?
That sounds like a TV show.
I said, well, you're a fisherman, I'm a farmer, best of both worlds.
There you go.
Right on.
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that. Good story. Have you heard your last story on the radio?
Yes.
It was good.
Your last story,
one of the stars.
I know the last time you were here, you were interviewing them about the businesses in Two Harbors.
The businesses in Two Harbors, and then favorite song and Old Shep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so, yeah, you've been on a lot. She's famous.
Indeed. Thank you, Lil. Yeah, so that brought some memories back, too. I remember the Wonderland Tourist Court, although I couldn't have come up with more than just Wonderland for the name of it, but that would have been back in the 1970s. I don't know how much longer than that it existed, but to hear that there had been 22 cabins, it was just north of the French River that Ryan Road comes down, and then you go over the French River, and it's in that next half mile somewhere, if I remember correctly. And it had some unique merchandise, and it was quite the place there for a while.
So was there more tourist places to stay along Scenic before? Is it more residential now than it was before?
Let's see. What I miss, I'm thinking of now, before you get to Knife River, between Duluth and Knife River, I don't recall, especially on the lake side, the highway is a lot closer to the lake there. So I would bet, except for Dodge's Log Lodges, which is still there, of course, that was probably the only place that had lodging on the lake side of the highway. And then there was another one that's still there on the upper side, the ones that each individual little cabin is painted a different color. And
there's quite a bit between Knife River and Two Harbors,
mm-hmm.
both on the water and along the Scenic.
And there's the big one that is, I get the names of them confused.
Ledge Rock.
Anyway, there are some. Well,
Breezy Cabins.
Crazy Cabins?
Breezy Point.
Oh, Breezy. Right.
Bob's,
so one
Bob's Cabins.
Back in the 80s and 90s, and I came up a few times with my mother, and we would stay in cabins, Bob's Cabins, which I don't know if that's in business anymore. You don't see it.
I see
the
signs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. There were these simple, just bare-bones cabins that had plumbing, but they'd always have a porch off the front and nothing like some of the fancy places that exist now. I think it's harder and harder to find just a basic cabin, rustic kind of almost. No, not necessarily rustic, just simple. and I'm sure that's what the Wonderland Tourist Court cabins were like. I never was actually at the cabins. I was just at the little general store there. And then the Shorecrest. That was a restaurant which, to look at it, you could tell that it had been a restaurant, but it hasn't been for many years. I think Nokomis was the last name of after the Shorecrest. So that's between the Scenic Cafe, the new Scenic Cafe, and the Homestead Road. Just yeah, I don't know how else to play it, place it near that, what's the is referred to as the Bluebird Landing. Anyway, really nice views, all windows. It's on the inland side of the highway, but up high enough that you're looking out over the lake, and would be a great place for a restaurant. Could use
if people could get employees and could afford the risk involved in restaurant touring.
Yeah, it's a hard row to hoe these days, I guess. So let's see. I'll do the other reading we have here, and then do we have one or two left here? We've got Shane has another submission for this week, and I think that's maybe it for the recorded ones, right? That's the one that didn't work. So we've got Shane's, and then actually we have couple of treats that will probably just fit in the end of the hour here. We're going to shift gears and talk about the eclipse a little bit. But
okay,
a couple of more job stories here. So Katya says that my first job was as a babysitter every Friday night and Sunday morning for two little girls, Sarah and Laura, while their parents went to our church's Friday supper and then church on Sunday. I don't remember much about it, except that when I could find time, I would pore over the main cookbook in the home, the Fanny Farmer Cookbook. Fanny Farmer wrote an extensive foreword to her cookbook, which I ate up, figuratively speaking, and which inspired me to begin developing my own philosophy of food and cooking. I was in the fifth grade. Now I look back and notice that my love of homemaking was taking root at that time. So actually, I have a very well-worn copy of the Fanny Farmer Cookbook
at home. As do I.
Do you?
One of my prized possessions.
Yeah, and mine is a paperback, very small, so it's amazing. It's like 3 inches thick. I think it has 1,000 pages. But I'm going to have to go back and look at the foreword to that, and I never really probably paid attention to the beginning, but it's a great resource. Some of my favorite recipes come from that still. Yeah, so Katya got her launch to homemaking from her babysitting job. Lots of babysitting jobs in our pasts here. So Shane had a very moving story last week about his very first job in a restaurant in Kentucky. And I think, if I recall from the age he says he was when this story occurred, it would have been before that job. So this was sort of not a job, but a contract, his first experience as a contractor, in a way. And so very well told again. So we'll listen to this from Shane Dickey.
This is Shane Dickey in Duluth, Minnesota, for KTWH Writers, and the prompt is my first job. Spring break came, and I needed money. Naturally, I thought of Carol Gastrite. Not because she had the money, though that she did, layered thick in the billfold she carried low in her back right pocket like any other job site laborer, but because she had the jobs. Carol had long been acquiring dilapidated properties in and around our Covington, Kentucky neighborhood to rehab and rent out. She was willing to hire just about anyone who could hold a paintbrush or push a broom, but a keen businesswoman is careful with her money, and Carol Gastrite's tight grip on her wallet was legend. I knew this, not just from talk around the backyard basketball courts, but because I had picked up the odd bit of work with Carol myself, raking leaves, scraping crumbling mortar from between courses of brick on an expansive exterior wall, jobs for which she had paid me no less than $8 an hour. Which is why, when I approached her that spring break halfway through my 14th year, I did so prepared to negotiate an increase in salary. Carol was in the backyard running a garden hose into the small in-ground pool she'd built herself. Though it was before 8, she already looked like she'd been hard at it, the knees of her jeans ground with mud and the sleeves of her blue chambray work shirt rolled past the elbows. I asked her if she had any work. She considered, then pointed toward the deep end. We've got a crack. We walked around the end of the pool and stood over a hairline running through the concrete walkway and 6 feet down the side of the pool to the bottom. To fix it, it was necessary to dig a hole deep and wide enough to construct a buttress. She stood with her arms spread wide. "It needs to be 4 feet by 4 feet," she explained, rotating 90 degrees, "and 7 feet deep." I looked down. That was a deep hole. "We'll have to break up the pad first, but I'll help you with that. Then you dig." My mind reeled. This was a big job. Anybody could see that. But I was no stranger to digging, was I? I helped my grandpa turn the soil over in his garden every year, and just the weekend before, my cousin Eric and I had set 4 new corner posts for our fort in the woods, sinking them 2 feet down, chopping through innumerable roots along the way. I started in on the math, wondering about just how to launch the opening salvo of my salary negotiation. Carol looked at me. "Well, what do you think?" "Oh, I can dig that hole," I said, "but it's a big job, and I'm not sure $8 an hour is fair." Carol Gastright gave me an appraising look. "Oh, really? What do you suggest?" I knew that real contractors worked not by the hour, but by the job. They'd look over the plumbing you needed done and quote you a price. That's where the real money was. I imagined myself with the shovel, arms bare to the noonday sun, red bandana tied around my neck, and did some quick calculations on volume and time. "How about $100? I said, shooting for the moon. That's how negotiations worked. Start big. Give yourself some wiggle room. To my surprise, Carol Gastright reached into her back pocket for the well-worn billfold. She withdrew a single bill and placed it in my palm. I'd never held a $100 bill before. Ben Franklin seemed to be winking at me. So did Carol Gastright. "The tools are in the shed." By noon that day, we had broken up the concrete. By nightfall, I was well enough into the dig to see that under the relatively thin layer of topsoil lay impossibly dense, solid red clay earth. The next day, I got started early and did well enough down to about 2.5 feet, where I met with an unexpected 8-inch tree root dissecting the hole. At 4 feet, a stepladder became necessary. The excavated earth was to be piled on the adjacent blue tarps, and not the grass, if you please. So it went, 1 5-gallon bucket at a time, up the ladder to empty, then back down for another. Every so often, Carol stopped by, look over my progress, gave me instruction. "More off the corner over here. It's getting too narrow over there." Once she brought me a glass of lemonade. By the fourth day, the $100 had evaporated, blown on Gatorade and Little Debbie Swiss rolls, plus one extravagant order of sweet and sour pork and large chicken fried rice from the Chinese takeout on the corner. But I kept at it. By week's end, as the sun receded behind the hill, I hauled out the last bucket as Carol approached with her tape measure. 4 by 4 by 7. She compressed her lips and gave a nod. I waited for her to go into the back pocket for the wallet. She'd seen how hard I'd worked, hadn't she? Was she not capable of reason, of pity? But instead, she reached out and took my exhausted right hand, many of its blisters already turning to callus, and shook it. "Good job," she said. And that was that. A deal was a deal.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
I thought that was a good song to follow that up with.
Yes. Well, Sean, Shane's story jiggled loose a memory of mine. I didn't realize I had as many jobs as I have had, and this whole prompt has really reminded me. But when I was in high school, during the summers, we had just moved to New York, Long Island, New York, and I started my own gardening business, and I worked for a couple of different people who had formal gardens and tending flowers and doing a lot of digging and a lot of heavy work. And I was really excited about transforming this little corner lot that my next-door neighbors had hired me to do. But being from California and moving to New York, I didn't realize that poison sumac was a thing.
I knew
I was allergic to poison ivy, but the entire corner lot was filled with sumac. And I tackled it all in one day. And ended up in the hospital.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
But and I was, you know, I learned why nobody had cleared that lot out ever before. But
Boy, learning the hard way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was hard.
Yeah. Well, and Shane learned quite a lesson from that experience.
Oh, yes.
And we heard about a very heartless woman, I would say.
Valuable lesson.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Well, we want to remind people the prompt for next week. This is all of the submissions we had for this one on jobs. You're still welcome to tell us more about your jobs next week if you like. But the new prompt for next week is Lake Superior. Any kinds of experiences you've had around Lake Superior or what it means to you?
It means a lot to me. Mm-hmm. I've only been here for 2 years, 2.5 years almost. And every day. It means a lot to me, and I'm purposely by it, and I know you are too.
Yeah, and you live actually literally inside of it. Right?
Inside of it? Maybe if I get a wetsuit, but in sight of it.
I should practice my enunciation. Indeed. Yeah, so send your submissions to KTWH Writers. Speaking of enunciation, that's WRITERS, right? KTWH Writers at gmail.com. By noon on Thursday, if possible, to be included in next week's show. And anything else we want to remind people of? We are going to
have courage. Stories. You know, I'm a very shy contributor, and I have a hard time coming up with things. But if something sparks your response, send it to us.
Right. And it doesn't have to be belabored.
The
show that we are modeling this after, he talks about free writing. And just sit down and write it out. Don't go back and edit it. And I mean, you're welcome to if you want to, but you don't have to. And you don't have to think of yourself as a writer by any means. We just want to hear from our listeners on whatever.
It's a fabulous opportunity for us to engage with each other.
Right. And we want to hear from you. Also, your ideas for prompts are welcome. We have a lot of ideas, but we will prioritize ones that the listeners submit, and we'll be doing one we got this week in a couple of weeks, I think. Not right away, but soon. So to shift gears, I guess, here. For the last few minutes.
You promised to talk about the eclipse.
Right. So you can't, anyone cannot avoid the fact that there's going to be a total eclipse of the sun tomorrow. Not tomorrow, Monday.
Monday.
Monday afternoon. And actually, Peg and I are driving several hours to get to where we may be able to witness it. And the weather's looking good.
Good.
Yeah.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah, mostly sunny. And actually, the one town we're looking at, it's a high of, it was either 73 or 76.
Oof.
I know, it's going to make it really hard to figure out how to dress or to take lots of layers and so forth.
how funny. Northern people have to figure out how to deal with the 70-degree weather.
Right. And, well, if it had been this morning, it was cold this morning, and I thought, well, I'm going to leave the house and be bundled up and then end up tomorrow or the next day with 75 degrees. But it will not be as cold tonight as it was last night still. But I happened to find this recording from LibriVox. It was written in 1899, I believe, by George Chambers. Right, it was published in 1899. It was a whole book, The Story of Eclipses. And this one chapter is called Strange Eclipse Customs. And he talks about what people in China, India, Native Americans, in Africa, many places thought about the eclipse back before they understood it as well as we do now, scientifically. And, oh, it's funny, at the beginning, he kind of worries about being politically correct of what that meant in 1899. So you'll hear how he tries to describe what he's going to be describing.
The Story of Eclipses by George F. Chambers. Chapter 18, Strange Eclipse Customs. I had intended heading this chapter, Eclipse Customs Amongst Barbarous Nations, but in these days it is dangerous to talk of barbarians or to speak one's mind on points of social etiquette, so I have thought it well to tone down the original title, otherwise I should have the partisans of the heathen Chinee holding me up to scorn as a reviler of the brethren. Did space permit, a very interesting record might be furnished of eclipse customs in foreign parts. An eclipse happened during Lord Macartney's embassy to China, which kept the emperor and his mandarins for a whole day devoutly praying the gods that the moon might not be eaten up by the great dragon which was hovering about her. The next day a pantomime was performed, exhibiting the battle of the dragon and the moon, and in which 200 or 300 priests, bearing lanterns at the end of long sticks, dancing and capering about, sometimes over the plain and then over chairs and tables, bore no mean part. Professor Russell, who is quoted elsewhere in this work with respect to Chinese eclipses, makes the following remarks in regard to what happens now in China when eclipses occur. Quote, "It will be interesting here to note that, even at present, by imperial command, special rites are performed during solar and lunar eclipses. A president from each of the 6 boards, with 2 inferior officials, dressed in their official clothes, proceed to the Tai Chang Su. When the eclipse begins, they change their robes for common garments made of plain black material, and, kneeling down, burn incense. The president then beats one stroke on a gong, and the ceremony is taken up by all the attendant officials." End quote. A writer in Chambers's journal, in an article entitled The Hindu View of the Late Eclipse, gives an interesting and original account of divers Hindu superstitions and ceremonies which came under his notice in connection with the total eclipse of the sun of August 18, 1868. He remarks that, quote, "European science has as yet produced but little effect upon the minds of the superstitious masses of India. Of the many millions who witnessed the eclipse of the 18th of August last, there were comparatively few who did not verily believe that it was caused by the dragon Rahu in his endeavor to swallow up the Lord of Day. The pious Hindu, before the eclipse comes on, takes a torch and begins to search his house and carefully removes all cooked food and all water for drinking purposes. Such food and water, by the eclipse, incur grahana sesha, that is, uncleanness, and are rendered unfit for use. Some, with less scruples of conscience, declare that the food may be preserved by placing it in darba or kusa grass." End quote. And much more to the like effect is duly set out in the interesting article cited. During the total eclipse of the sun of August 7, 1869, the following incident is noted to have occurred at a station on the Chilcot River in Alaska, North America, frequented by Indians. Quote, "About the time the sun was half obscured, the chief Ku Klux and all the Indians had disappeared from around the observing tent. They left off fishing on the river banks. All employments were discontinued, and every soul disappeared, nor was a sound heard throughout the village of 53 houses. The natives had been warned of what would take place, but doubted the prediction. When it did occur, they looked upon me as the cause of the sun's being very sick and going to bed. They were thoroughly alarmed and overwhelmed with an undefinable dread." End quote. A still more thrilling incident is thus recorded of the eclipse of July 29, 1878, by a witness at Fort Sill, Indian Territory, U.S. Quote, "On Monday last, we were permitted to see the eclipse of the sun in a beautiful bright sky. Not a cloud was visible. We had made ample preparation, laying in a stock of smoked glass several days in advance. It was the grandest sight I ever beheld, but it frightened the Indians badly. Some of them threw themselves upon their knees and invoked the divine blessing. Others flung themselves flat on the ground, face downward. Others cried and yelled in frantic excitement and terror. Finally, one old fellow stepped from the door of his lodge, pistol in hand, and fixing his eyes on the darkened sun, mumbled a few unintelligible words, and raising his arm took direct aim at the luminary, fired off his pistol, and after throwing his arms about his head in a series of extraordinary gesticulations, retreated to his own quarters. As it happened, that very instant was the conclusion of totality. The Indians beheld the glorious orb of day once more peep forth, and it was unanimously voted that the timely discharge of that pistol was the only thing that drove away the shadow and saved them from the public inconvenience that would have certainly resulted from the entire extinction of the sun." End quote. A certain Mr. F. Kerrigan, in a book published in 1844, made the following remarks on ancient Jewish ideas respecting eclipses. Quote, "The Israelites, like their benighted neighbors, esteemed an eclipse of either luminary as a supernatural and inauspicious omen, which filled them with the most gloomy and fearful apprehensions, as may fairly be deduced from the 8th chapter of Ezekiel, verse 15. Quote, "Then he brought me to the door of the Lord's house, which was towards the north, and behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz." End quote. Now Tammuz is the name under which Adonis is known in Palestine. He was the favorite of Venus, or Astarte, the principal goddess of the Philistines and Phoenicians. Being killed by a wild boar, the prevailing superstition of the age induced the uninformed multitude to believe that when the moon was eclipsed, it was in compliment to their beloved goddess Venus or Astarte, who, concealed behind the full moon, sat weeping under a dark veil for the loss of her beloved Tammuz or Adonis. End quote. The African travelers, R. and J. Lander, have given a graphic account of what took place on the occasion of an eclipse of the moon of September 2, 1830, as witnessed by themselves. Quote, "The earlier part of the evening had been mild, serene, and remarkably pleasant. The moon had arisen with uncommon luster, and being at the full, her appearance was extremely delightful. It was the conclusion of the holidays, and many of the people were enjoying the delicious coolness of a serene night, and resting from the laborious exertions of the day. But when the moon became gradually obscured, fear overcame everyone. As the eclipse increased, they became more terrified. All ran in great distress to inform their sovereign of the circumstance, for there was not a single cloud to cause so deep a shadow, and they could not comprehend the nature or meaning of an eclipse. Groups of men were blowing on trumpets, which produced a harsh and discordant sound. Some were employed in beating old drums, others again were blowing on bullocks' horns. The diminished light, when the eclipse was complete, was just sufficient for us to distinguish the various groups of people, and contributed in no small degree to render the scene more imposing. If a European, a stranger to Africa, had been placed on a sudden in the midst of the terror-struck people, he would have imagined himself to be among a legion of demons, holding a revel over a fallen spirit." End quote. End of chapter 18 of The Story of Eclipses.
So thank you very much for listening. Our prompt for next week, or this week, through next Thursday, is Lake Superior, all your thoughts and feelings about that subject. We do hope that you will join us, either by listening or contributing or both.